This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show. You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio, heard weekdays from noon to one. Now, Fight Back with Libby Znaimer on Zoomer Radio.
Good afternoon and welcome. It's Wednesday, time to talk about your health, and there are reverberations of the controversy surrounding Kate, the Princess of Wales. The UK's privacy watchdog is investigating the reported prying of Princess Kate's medical records by staff at the private London hospital, where she underwent abdominal surgery in January. Now, I remember a similar case here back in 2016. Two health workers who snooped into late Mayor Rob Ford's electronic health records were convicted under the province's health privacy law. Also, some worrying results from a study on a very popular diet that is especially popular with Zoomers, intermittent fasting. Now, those findings show this may radically increase the risk of death due to cardiovascular disease. But we've got the experts, and we'll talk about how reliable these results actually are. And another new study finds that Viagra, which is used to treat erectile dysfunction, may help protect against Alzheimer's disease. And the authors make a leap from may protect to suggesting that Viagra should be authorized as a novel treatment for Alzheimer's. What could possibly go wrong? The numbers to call, 416-360-0740, toll free 1-866-740-4740.
Now, time for The Medical Record.
And now I'd like to welcome Dr. Malcolm Moore, who is a medical oncologist at Princess Margaret and the former head of the BC Cancer Agency, Dr. Elisa Naiman, family physician and founder and medical director of the Medical Station in Toronto, and Dr. Jamie Spiegelman, internal medicine and critical care physician at Humber River Hospital. Hi, and thanks for joining us. Welcome, everybody.
Hello.
Let's begin with Malcolm. So what do you make of this investigation into a privacy breach? And have we dealt with that eventuality properly here in Toronto?
Well, I would say that I think this finding is distressing but not surprising. And you actually alluded to the situation with former Mayor Rob Ford at Princess Margaret, actually, where two staff were actually convicted of snooping into his medical record. I think that just for the readers who maybe don't work in the hospital sector, the way electronic health records work, it's very easy to do this. So if you log into the UHN website, which would have the medical records of all people at UHN, if you log into the medical record, once you're in there, you can search any patient and look into the medical records of that patient. And what people perhaps don't understand is that that's all tracked. So if when you have a high-profile patient like Rob Ford or like the royal family, then it's quite easy for the people monitoring the IT system to look at who actually looked into that person's record. So it's very easy for the person to do it, but it's also very easy to catch them, because if you're not in what's defined as the circle of care, then you're not supposed to be looking into people's medical records. And we all have a lot of, we actually, as part of our annual appointments, we have to review, we have to go through a course on this just to make this very clear. So just because someone happens to be in your hospital does not give you the right to look at their medical record unless you're directly involved in the care for them. And I think whenever you have a higher profile patient like this, then there's going to be a higher level of scrutiny, and it won't be difficult to identify, I don't think, if people looked into Kate's medical records.
And when you say you can log in, it's doctors who can log in. Can other health professionals log in, or is it only doctors who have access to everything?
No, it's anybody within the care team. So in the case of Princess Margaret, when the people were convicted, I think one was a radiation therapist, another was a radiation technologist. So nurses, everyone who provides direct care to patients is able to log into the system to look at the person's medical record that they're looking after, and in some cases to add notes or comments. So it would be social workers, nurses, respiratory therapists, anybody involved in the care can log into the medical record and access the records. What doesn't happen, which would be very cumbersome, is that you don't have to secondarily log into the medical record of each patient who's at your hospital.
Yeah, lots of administration. And Dr. Spiegelman, you know, is interesting. Personally, when I was being treated for cancer, I asked some questions, or I told some things to previous doctors that I had who were not in the immediate circle, and they wanted something in writing. They said, give us something in writing so we don't get dinged for looking into your records. So I have confidence that that is under control. Is that a problem you found at Humber, which is all digital?
Everything is digital, so everything is on the electronic record, very similar to Princess Margaret here. And it is an issue for all our staff, especially when there is a VIP in the hospital, that we keep on reminding ourselves that, and we, all our screensavers on our computer actually have this, that you should not be, medical records are the privacy of the patient, and you should not go into that patient's chart unless you're part of the care team for that patient. So this is an ongoing issue, and I get this a lot too. I get, like, from nurses, oh, can you look at my records? And I'm like, well, I'm not really part of your care team. I can't look at your records. It's illegal for me, as per the Personal Health Information Protection Act, for me to look at your records. So it's a very big issue. And when Rob Ford, like you mentioned, he was actually at Humber before he went to Mount Sinai and Princess Margaret. And when he was there, I was part of his care team at Humber River. So I treated him personally, and I made it clear to all the staff that they should not go into his chart. And at that time, we were still pretty electronic, and it was, you know, like almost 10 years ago. And it's quite clear to our care team that the patient's records is very confidential. It's a key part to the not only the physician-patient relationship, but the hospital-patient relationship. And any breach of that is a breach of trust between the patient and the healthcare system. And if this happens as a patient, I would be quite upset. So what happened to Kate is not surprising, but should not happen.
Dr. Naiman, does it come up? Is it an issue in a GP practice?
All of the doctors, we have 7,000 patients in the clinic. I potentially could go into anybody's chart, but I don't, because anybody who is not my patient, if there's not a reason for me to be in the chart, then I'm not part of the care team, and so I shouldn't. And within our EMR system, which is different than the EMR system that's in hospitals, every single click that is made is tracked. So if there was any issue of anything, I could go back and run the log of everything and see who has been in somebody's chart. And it's been made very clear to the admin, especially if, you know, there's relatives or people who they know who are within the practice, you are not allowed to access somebody's chart unless it's part of your job and responsibilities of your job. And as for other physicians, we don't go into other patients' charts unless we're physically seeing the patient within the office. The other way that it plays out in a family practice office is that we can link into other databases within Ontario. And if, you know, you're my patient and I need to go and access something that's potentially at a different hospital that hasn't come in through my EMR, I can go into a different system that's called Connecting Ontario. And one time I went to pull out records for a patient, and I was actually blocked from doing it, and the patient had at some point requested advanced security on his file so that nobody could access these records. And when I called him and said, I can't get these records, you put a block on it, he didn't really know what I was talking about. And then it took some time for him to be able to get this block taken off. So there are security measures that are put in place and that can be put in place. And I'm sure at every hospital when there's some high-profile person who comes in, and I am sure that these files are blocked. And I'm sure that in the hospital in London that they were very aware if anybody was trying to access it, and they wouldn't be able to access that file, even if they were an employee of the hospital.
Okay, let's move along to this intermittent fasting study that's gotten a huge amount of attention. And I know people who have found this to be a good way of losing weight. What do you make of this study? Malcolm, have you had a look at it?
Yeah, I had a look at the article, and, you know, to me, this smacks of what often you see in the media. This sounds super interesting, like people are interested in diet, people are interested in fasting, etc. But if you actually read the article, the comment I agreed with the most was one of the cardiologists who was asked about it, who said, look, you know, I'm not going to base any decisions on a study where people filled out a dietary questionnaire for 2 days and then were monitored for the next 20 years. I don't think we can draw firm conclusions from that. And so I think it's really hard to say, you know, because this is self-reported diet over a 2-day period. And if you look further in the article, they did find out that the people who said they were doing this type of diet, in terms of their all-cause mortality, or which is, did they live longer than people who didn't diet like this, or did they live shorter? There was no difference in that. And one of the other problems with these massive studies where you do where you look at multiple things, they probably looked at cardiac disease, obesity, cancer, car accidents, suicide. Whenever you do multiple comparisons, inevitably some of those comparisons seem to show an apparent difference, but that's just because you're doing a lot of analyses. And the other thing I would say is I had a couple of family members who were doing one of these diets where you don't eat till 12 o'clock and then you stop eating at 8 p.m. And what I noticed was that when they started eating at 12 o'clock, they were ravenous.
Yeah.
They would eat large amounts of food, and I remember looking at one of them and thinking, this can't be healthy, you know, like eating an enormous amount of food at 12 o'clock because you're starving and kind of making your food, like if you're a snake or something, maybe you only eat every 3 days, but if you're a person, I think spreading it out through the day seems a much more sensible approach to me.
Elisa, do any of your patients swear by this, or have they asked you about it?
Absolutely. This is a common diet that is brought up to find out if they can do it or that they're doing it. This has sort of replaced a ketogenic diet that was very popular maybe like 6-7 years ago. People don't come in and talk about that anymore. People will come in and talk about intermittent fasting and say that they're fasting. It's interesting. This study is not a very rigorous study. This is not a randomized controlled trial. This is an observational study, as Dr. Moore has mentioned, that it's based on 2 days of diet information that then they project out for 10 years to determine mortality. And as we've talked on other shows about the chicken wings, that people think that during this window of time you can go and eat whatever. Well, you can. It depends on the quality of the food and what you're eating. And I think one of the arguments in terms of whether or not this diet works is that you're actually reducing the calories that you're eating during this window. And so as Dr. Moore said, that people in his family are ravenous and they're eating a lot of food, it sort of defeats the purpose of this type of intervention. So for some people, they find that it really works. For other people, they find that it doesn't. And I think it just sort of shows that you have to find what works for you. There's no magic diet that will work for everybody. It has never been found and it won't be found. It's what you feel will work for you. And if this is a mechanism that allows you to consume less calories in a day, then it will be helpful. But you have to eat properly during this window.
And Dr. Spiegelman, I mean, every other study shows that if you lose weight on it and your blood pressure goes down and other cardiovascular indicators, that that's healthy as opposed to risking more cardiovascular disease, no?
Yes, no, I agree. I think this is a very poor study from what we got, and I agree with Dr. Moore and Dr. Lehman about that. And as someone who does intermittent fasting, intermittently, I don't do it all the time, I've looked into a lot of the previous studies and read Jason Fung's book, who's the expert in the Canada and the world on this, and there are definite benefits in terms of weight loss, decreasing your cholesterol, diabetes improving. So there's lots of other benefits that are well documented in other studies. And there has to be something to intermittent fasting or time-restricted eating. If you think about it, every major religion has some kind of fasting in their as part of their religion. Right now we're in Ramadan for the Muslims. There's Lent for Christians, and there's Yom Kippur for Jews. So there's something historical about fasting that has benefit to health. And what I see with myself, but also the patients that I see and friends that do intermittent fasting, is you don't only get the long-term health benefits. What I find is you do get the mental health benefits. You feel more awake and alert with it. And, of course, you have to watch what you're eating when you're eating, when you're in the eating phase of the day. And, obviously, it does come down to calories in and calories out in terms of weight gain and benefit as well. So you have to eat healthy while you intermittent fast.
So when you do it, what's your window of eating and what's your window of fasting?
I vary. The standard is to eat between 12 and 8. So you're fasting between 8 p.m. and 12 noon, so you don't eat breakfast. You have a black coffee. So anything, you're allowed drinking non-calorie beverages. So usually I have a black coffee. But, you know, sometimes I do a two-day fast, for example, too. Like I'll eat and I won't do it, and then I'll do a two-day fast or a 72-hour fast. And you actually, the first couple of hours, the first 8 hours is quite tough, but, you know, you feel great on it. And, you know, I don't recommend it for everyone. It's more of a personal challenge sometimes, but typically it's the eating period, as described in most literature, is between 12 and 8.
Okay, yeah. And it doesn't affect your brain? You don't get kind of foggy? Hungry?
Not as long as I have a coffee with some caffeine in it, no. I actually feel better. Like, you feel way more awake and with it, actually.
I don't feel like that when I fast. I'm going to take a call from Lewis in Toronto. Hi, Lewis.
Hi, Libby. How are you?
Fine. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Okay. So I've been doing this intermittent fasting for years, and I don't really consider it a diet. It's just, for me, it's giving my body a break in the evening to rest and do what it has to do, like detox and everything. So I kind of eat like 6 a.m. to 6 p.m. in the evening, and then I stop at 6 p.m., and that's kind of like a 12-hour window there. So I can't see why, like, if you were to eat, if I was to eat like 6, 7, or 8, or even 9, 10, 11, I would think that would do more harm to me, having all that food sitting there, you know, and then not having, and then you're getting up at 6 or 7 again and eating again.
Well, it works for you.
It gives your body a break, really. It's not really a diet.
Have you lost weight?
Eating the same. Oh, no, I don't lose weight. I've been on a plant-based diet for 8 years now as well, and my weight's always the same. Actually, I've gained weight since I've gone plant-based. When I was eating meat, I was very low in weight, and I couldn't understand why.
Okay. Well, as the doctor said, if it works for you, it works for you. I guess on this one, some of the blame maybe might go to my colleagues. It looked like the right kind of headline, so it got a lot of play. Moving right along to another study, this one is about using Viagra for Alzheimer's, or I wasn't clear on whether it's just to lower the risk of Alzheimer's, and then there was a suggestion, use it as a novel drug. Dr. Moore, do you have an opinion on that?
Okay, so I looked at this, and if I understand the study, I haven't looked at I just looked at the report, but it's that what they did was they looked at medication use and then linked it to illnesses. And so, and what they found was that people who use Viagra had a lower incidence of dementia than people who weren't using it. Now, you could also interpret that people who are not demented are more likely to have sex than people who have dementia, and that's why they're using a product, because that's why you're using Viagra. So I think it's a bit of a stretch to then say that this is a potential treatment for Viagra. I mean, from the biological point of view, we know that Alzheimer's is an accumulation of damage to the brain over many years. So if you're going to take any sort of treatment for it, you basically have to take it every day. And I think maybe the sensible thing is, hey, this is an observation. Let's do a study and study whether this class of drugs has some effect on the development of dementia. But that's a much bigger undertaking. And as you said, you know, would involve people taking Viagra every day.
Yeah, I mean, and one of the things that affects some people as dementia progresses, and I've seen this, especially in a guy who was our neighbor for many years, is that they get sexually aggressive. And, in that case, it was mostly only saying really inappropriate things. But there have been these cases at nursing homes when people who are suffering with dementia, I mean, assault people sexually. You'd think that would exacerbate it. Dr. Naiman?
I think it was more that in studies they go to see if they can repurpose things, and this was based on a database of people who were taking Viagra, and then they looked to see whether or not they developed Alzheimer's. But there was a study in 2022 that actually, a randomized controlled trial, that did not find a benefit. So I think it becomes very hard to tease out whether or not there is any type of benefit with taking an erectile dysfunction medication. The mechanism, they do say that there is a biologic plausibility for that it would help, but you bring up an interesting point of other confounders that exist as part of the illness, depending on where the illness affects in your brain. Then people often will become sexually disinhibited, and then there have been reports of people being sexually assaulted within long-term care facilities. So you do bring up an interesting point. And just another example, this is now two studies that we've now talked about today, which reach headlines, which it's based on poor evidence of data, but the information gets out into the media and people start to talk about it.
Yeah. There was another, I don't know if it was a full study, regarding Alzheimer's. And basically what it said was that one of the ways to tell, because it's very hard to get a diagnosis, is through people's speech. And it's not so much forgetting words, but it's if they speak really, really slowly, that can be an indicator. Does that sound like a promising avenue, Jamie?
Yeah, I mean, it's possible. It's really hard to know the real effects. Going back to Viagra, it's a drug that I actually use for other purposes in my patients, actually. So when I look at a drug and I look at a study like this, I look at the mechanism of the way the drug works on the patient's body, right? And I know the study was looking at RNA levels and protein levels of regulation of it, but Viagra is a vasodilator, which means it dilates our blood vessels, and that's how it works as a erectile dysfunction drug. And we use it quite a bit in our patients that have high pressures in their lungs called pulmonary hypertension. So if their pressures are pretty high for whatever reason, whether you have sleep apnea or you have lung disease and it's causing high pressures in your lung and your heart, we actually use it quite frequently. It's a good effect on these patients. So extrapolating that to the brain, you know, is it by vasodilating the brain that you're getting more blood flow to the brain? It's possible. So it's a possible mechanism that this drug works. The evidence so far is pretty poor, however.
Okay. Before we wrap things up, something that affects really a lot of people. You wouldn't know it today, but we've had very mild temperatures early spring, not today again, and a lot of early allergies, not to mention confusion in the garden. So, Dr. Naiman, what do you tell your patients and what have you seen this season?
So it's actually been a trend that's been happening over the last couple of years. People start complaining of having allergies in March, and I think this year, and also interestingly enough, with these just changes in the weather patterns, people have really been complaining about migraines a lot, and this usually doesn't happen until April or May, so that definitely is much earlier. I think last week, 5 people complained to me about their migraines, and then people just are starting now, oh, I'm starting to get my nasal congestion, I'm starting to get my watery eyes, and then it's, you got to get started on your medication. So that, you know, can include a nasal spray. It can involve an oral antihistamine. There's allergy eye drops that people take. And then they're told that you've got to take it for the season. But now it appears with global warming and this year with El Nino that people will be taking these medications for longer and longer this year.
And is there any big problem with that?
No. And actually, some people are actually on oral antihistamines all year round, and they're taking it constantly. So I think it becomes more of an issue of managing your symptoms, and people should not be afraid of taking an antihistamine on a daily basis. It really does make a difference. You sort of have to get control of things early so that things don't get bad. People, you know, nobody likes taking a medication every day, so people will stop and start it. And what they find, and what I find, is that they don't actually have good symptom control, and they just continue to complain. And if people just take their medication every day for this window of time, if you need it, you know, you might be one of these early spring allergy people, or you could be a late summer person, that you've got to take it for that season, and you will find a benefit for your symptoms. So I encourage everybody, if you feel like your allergies have started, it probably has. The weather is so cold today that the pollen count is low, but they're starting to report pollen counts on TV, so you know that it's starting.
Okay. Dr. Spiegelman, do you have anything to add to that?
I guess along those lines, I guess a daily reactant a day keeps the doctor away. I just came back from March break from Washington, and there was pretty very, very mild there, and there's cherry blossoms everywhere. My younger son was, who does have environmental allergies and seasonal allergies, was going crazy with. So, you know, prescribing reactant a day usually subsides his symptoms. So I think I agree. You have to take the medications routinely rather than as needed when the symptoms are severe.
And Malcolm, should people just go and get it over the counter, or should they consult a doctor before they start taking it every day?
You mean for allergies?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think you over-the-counter medications for these sorts of, you know, unless it's very severe. And I do have to say, you know, I learn something from this show every week, and I have migraines, and I did notice that the last few weeks I've been having more than usual. So based on Alicia's comments, at least now I understand the reason.
Wow, okay. I hope it's helping people in the audience as much, but that's very good to hear. So thank you so much, Dr. Elisa Naiman, Dr. Jamie Spiegelman, and Dr. Malcolm Moore. And I hope you don't have any migraines anytime soon. Bye-bye.
Bye now.
Okay, we are taking a break. And when we come back, we are going to talk to the author of a very interesting article noting the differences of our politicians' responses to the protests that we're seeing now versus those convoy protests when we return.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio, heard weekdays from noon to one. Fight Back with Libby Znaimer on Zoomer Radio.
Welcome back. The ongoing and sometimes violent pro-Palestinian and pro-Hamas protests have a lot of people comparing them to the convoy protests that choked Ottawa for months during the pandemic. The big difference, according to our next guest, is the silence from our political leaders, despite the fact that the current demonstrations feature more frightening messages and intimidation targeting Canadian Jews. So the numbers to call, what do you think? 416-360-0740, toll free 1-866-740-4740. And now I'm joined by Joanna Baron, who is the Executive Director of the Canadian Constitution Foundation. Hi, Joanna. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, Libby. Good to be here.
So what made you focus on this aspect of how there's been such a different reaction and different kinds of comments from the politicians?
Well, it was just unmistakable to me. Obviously, I was following the Freedom Convoy as it dragged on, as it became definitely a huge obstruction. But from the beginning, what was amazing to me was that the Prime Minister was very strident in, you know, seeking to point out the extremists, which every street movement has extremists, but really painting that protest movement as a movement of a small fringe minority with unacceptable views, and highlighting the one or two really atrocious examples, I think, of swastikas being cited, which no doubt there were unsavory elements of that movement, although there was no demonstration of violence. Contrast that with what we've seen in our streets across the country, really, since October 7th, including a lot of very regrettable, and I do think these are outliers, but instances of calling for jihadi violence against Jews. And we've heard almost complete silence from our political leaders, certainly from Justin Trudeau, but even Olivia Chow, Doug Ford. They've been very, very equivocal. And you're hearing things like citing parts of the Hadith, which says a day will come when every tree and every rock will call out, O Muslim, there is a Jew hiding behind me, come and kill him. You know, this is very serious stuff. And so to me, it's just a glaring double standard that nobody seems to want to talk about. And I got a lot of pushback from my piece recently when I just had to call it out and say, this is extraordinary. Why is this happening?
Well, exactly. And there have been quite a number of violent incidents. There was a Jewish store that was torched, Canadian Jewish store. Some businesses have been targeted. I mean, a hospital, you know, Mount Sinai Hospital, which is completely ecumenical. I mean, it has people, it's for people of all religions, but is historically connected to the Jewish community. It was blocked and targeted as a protest. And I think there were a few people who said, oh, it's not really good. But you're right. What do you think is behind this double standard?
Well, unfortunately, I have a pretty cynical view. I think from the beginning of the Freedom Convoy movement, Prime Minister Trudeau had already decided that he could effectively wedge against people who were critical of lockdowns, vaccine mandates. We already saw in the federal election that just preceded the convoy movement that he had decided to just demonize a small sliver of the population, which he calculated was represented by the convoy because a majority of Canadians were not sympathetic to them, right? A majority of Canadians supported invoking the Emergencies Act and supported the vaccine passports. Now the political calculations for the Liberals, I believe, are different. They're very fearful of losing the vote of people who are broadly sympathetic to the pro-Palestinian cause. And so I really think there's just underlying electoral calculus, which is an unfortunate reality. I would argue that it doesn't obviate the need for some type of moral clarity. And calling out, as you said, there's sort of two things I point to that are really unacceptable in my piece. The first is, as you pointed out, the targeting of Jewish businesses, neighborhoods, hospitals. For example, my brother couldn't drive his kids home from swim lessons for about 3 weeks when the bridge in Armour Heights was being targeted. He doesn't have any influence on the Israeli government's war policy, I'm sorry to say. So that's one category. And then, of course, the other category is outright calls for violence, outright calls for we're going to kill you. And I'm talking beyond the from the river to the sea stuff. I'm talking about in a synagogue in Montreal, pro-Palestinian protesters saying essentially one day is going to come where we're going to kill every Jew, citing religious texts. That is not acceptable in a pluralistic democracy.
Well, yeah, and I mean, the police who have been very reluctant to lay charges, and I have to say, if it's a peaceful protest, fine. I don't think it should block places like places of worship or hospitals, but a peaceful protest, this is a democracy. We don't want to take away the right to protest, but really some of it is out of control. The police are very reluctant and they say, oh, well, we might lay charges at a later time, but generally speaking, they do not.
Yeah, they really seem to be, from what I've heard from various sources, the police seems to have an internal directive to sort of stand down and take a stance of extreme caution. And it might be because they're fearful of inflaming the situation further. But we saw even in cases, I think, towards the end of the year last year in a mall in Toronto, where there was a protester who was effectively menacing the police. And even then, they took a very de-escalatory approach, which may or may not be appropriate. But in my piece, I talk about how Rishi Sunak, who has seen a similar phenomenon.
Prime Minister of the UK, just to remind people, go ahead.
Yes, has seen, you know, many months of very disruptive protests with many outright anti-Semitic incidents. I think really eloquently said, of course you have the right to protest. Of course you have the right to object to what's going on in Gaza, but you do not have the right to call for violent jihad, and you do not have the right to harass Jewish people in the streets. And he didn't really give any specific directives to the police. But even just sort of standing up and delineating as the leader of a country what the line is, I think is very important for the whole country to understand that, yes, there are boundaries. Of course, we support free speech and protest is an important mechanism. But there are certain things that we have to realize that when there are individuals in our society who want to go against the principles that make our free society work in the first place, respect for religious minorities, respect for the rule of law, we have to guard against that. And unfortunately, that is the nature of what we've seen over these last 6 months.
Okay. Anything else you want to leave us with, Joanne?
Just stay safe out there.
Okay. Thank you so much for that. Joanna Baron, the Executive Director of the Canadian Constitution Foundation. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Okay, we are taking another break, and when we come back, we're going to be talking to the mayor of Niagara Falls. Now, they're expecting 1 million people to come and see the eclipse. So, people, I'd like to know, do you have plans to go somewhere to see the eclipse? One of my first questions to him is going to be, well, how do you figure, where does that number come from? Because it boggles the mind. It really does, though everybody is excited about that eclipse. We'll be on it when we come back.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. Heard weekdays from noon to one. Fight Back with Libby Znaimer on Zoomer Radio.
Welcome back. Niagara Falls is expecting its biggest day ever. It has been declared to be one of the best, if not the best, place to see the total solar eclipse on April the 8th. Now, the mayor, the police, telecoms, everybody, they're bracing themselves as 1 million visitors are expected. So first of all, I'd like to know, do you have plans to see the eclipse? Did you get those goggles because it can cause damage to the eyes? But do you know where you'd like to see it from? 416-360-0740, toll free 1-866-740-4740. And now I'm joined by the mayor of Niagara Falls, Ontario, Jim Diodati. Hi, thanks for joining us.
Oh, thanks for having me, Libby.
Okay, well, first of all, where do you get this number? 1 million people are going to come. What is that based on?
Well, you know, we've got a major Emmy Award-winning U.S. documentary company that covers events just like this, and they're up filming beforehand, meeting with our emergency operations center and the police and fire and tracking, and they said, do you have any idea what to expect? And we said, no, just we know there'll be a lot of people. It's Niagara Falls. And they said, well, what's the biggest event you've ever had? And we said, well, that would be Nick Willenda in 2012. We had 130,000 to 150,000 people that day. You know, we had to close roads. We had to add GO trains. And they said, well, expect 8 to 9 times that number. And we all stopped in our tracks. And we said, you got to be kidding. They said, no, that's the number you need to prepare for. So that's where the numbers started.
But where did they get it from?
Well, they've been tracking. It's not their first eclipse that they've covered. Ah. So they've been covering these events, and that's when they said to us, from our experience, this is the number you need to build toward, and we were a little bit stunned. So ever since that day, we're preparing for 1 million people.
Wow. I mean, I wonder what the view is like from the highway, because I don't
Oh, my gosh.
Can you...
No, Libby, I'm telling you, we're it's. I'm guessing the QEW could become a linear parking lot right to the GTA. So we're telling everybody, don't. So here's the thing: we're within a day's drive of almost half the population of North America.
Right.
We get 14 million people a year. We're used to big crowds, but not all at the same time. And we're telling people, make plans, be organized, measure twice, cut once. So if you're planning to come and you want to be part of the experience, like you said, you know, National Geographic said we're the best place in the world to see this. And it's a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. The last total solar eclipse in Niagara Falls was 99 years ago, and the next one will be in 120 years. So I can tell you, for me, it's the last one I'll be seeing. And I'm sure most people, unless there's some major advances in science. So we're saying, if you want to do it, and some people have said, why do you think it's so special here? And I said, well, I think because it's not man-made. This is Mother Nature, and we can't compete with Mother Nature. You've got one of the great natural wonders of the world, the iconic Niagara Falls, and then you've got this celestial wonder happening at the same time in the same place, some magical, mystical feeling about the event. So we're preparing for everything and anything. And I'm telling people, don't get up the morning of and say, hey, what do you say we drive to Niagara Falls? Plan in advance. Come days early. Make sure your gas tank is full or your car is charged and you've got cereal bars and your medication with you. Don't show up at the last
minute. Take your medication. Oh, my goodness. I remember a few years ago, my husband and I, we were already out west and there was an eclipse happening and we were in Tofino and it was a pretty big bust, to be honest.
It was. Well, I think because it's Niagara Falls, and again, because of our proximity, and we're already the number one leisure destination in the country, I think people are used to coming here for lots of reasons, and this will just be that once-in-a-lifetime experience. And I really only know from past experience what to expect. So what we've decided to do is we've got it broken down into two categories. One is for safety, where we've got our emergency operations, we've got all of our police, fire, ambulance, and all levels of provincial, regional, and municipal working in tandem so that everybody will be safe wherever they are. And assuming we're not going to be able to drive anywhere, we'll have stations. And on the other end, we've got the whole experience, the tourism, because today and the fun and the entertainment, people want experiential tourism more than ever. They want to eat what the locals eat, drink what the locals drink. They want to experience things firsthand. Whereas the last partial solar eclipse in Niagara Falls was 1979. I was in school and I remember they huddled us in the classroom, closed the curtains, stay away from the windows. Well, today it's different. They're saying, get your goggles, go out and experience it firsthand. It's educational, experiential. So the world's changed. People look at things like this differently, and rather than hide from them, they tend to embrace them.
Okay, I want to give the numbers out again because I really would like to hear from people who have made plans or are thinking about making plans. And I gather it's even hard to get some of those glasses. I keep asking my husband to do that. 416-360-0740, toll-free 1-866-740-4740. I'm talking to Jim Diodati, who's the mayor of Niagara Falls, and they say they're expecting 1 million people, which seems like really an out-of-sight number. What about hotel rooms? Are they all booked? And I think that we had a brief look at the prices, and they were, wow.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, there's not too many rooms left, and they're definitely more expensive. You know, it's dynamic pricing. It's like if you want to go see a Super Bowl game or, you know, when there's high demand, high season, you're going to pay more. And this is like high.
$800 or $1,000 a night, something like that.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. It's definitely top dollar for sure. So I know a lot of people are even planning on letting people park a motorhome in their driveway for the day. People are pitching tents in the backyard. They're doing room rentals. Farmers are letting RVs and tents set up in their properties. There's a lot of people that want to take this in, and there's going to be people in this gig economy that want to benefit from it. and we're trying to alleviate the pressures, and we're opening up extra parking areas. We're trying to get tourism employees to park away from the tourism core inside the city. We're trying to do anything we can. In fact, you know, some people had said, well, why do you have entertainment performing to draw more people? And we said, it's not to draw more people. It's to get them to not all leave immediately after the eclipse so that they'll slowly peel away. Because what we've learned in the past, New Year's Eve, we host a big show, and at midnight, we do the final fireworks. And right after, everybody beelines to their car to get to the casino or the hotels or the restaurants. And the problem is you have traffic gridlock. So we're trying to, we've got the Niagara Symphony Orchestra, who will play during the actual eclipse with some very appropriate, ominous music. And then we'll have a bunch of Canadian entertainment on the stage. We're going to have NASA will be here, the Canadian Space Agency, the Guinness Book of World Records. There's going to be a lot of people here, and we're trying to get people to generally, gradually leave the event so that the roads are not, you know, absolute gridlock.
My producer has asked a very reasonable question, and that is about the public washroom situation.
Well, that's a great question, and we're working obviously very closely with the Niagara Parks Commission, and we're bringing in a lot of extra washroom facilities. We're bringing in extra of everything. In fact, we've even brought in extra cellular towers. They call them cows, where we find the bandwidth gets used up when there's too many people at one time. We've experienced it New Year's Eve when we'll get 60 to 80,000 people for a live concert, and at midnight, everybody's FaceTiming or texting or emailing at the same time, and nothing goes through. So we're trying to get this extra bandwidth, and as well, we compete with the U.S. signals. So we're trying to prepare for everything, from washrooms to water to health stations to food. You know, we're trying to address everything based on this crazy high number of 1 million people. Regardless of what that number is, we know it'll be big. And the biggest variable, Libby, is the weather. So, as I mentioned, we're within a day's drive of almost half the population in North America. We call it the rubber tire market, who people that will drive here, and many people base it on the weather. So we're a little far out to know what the weather is going to be. We just know it can be anything in April. So we're watching very closely. We know that'll have an impact on how many people actually show up.
Well, if I were you, I'd be hoping it's not 1 million, because I don't think there's any way you can be ready for that. And you mentioned New Year's Eve, and here in Toronto on New Year's Eve, it couldn't even handle the subway, like, was mobbed after, you know, an event, an event that happens every year, certainly in downtown Toronto. So, and I mean, even Kingston is expecting 500,000 people.
Well, they can have a few of ours. You know, Libby, too, they're going to be there'll be an announcement later in the month from Metrolinx. They're going to be adding on extra trains, as they did for Nick Wallenda. And that day as well will be the home opener for the Toronto Blue Jays, and I believe there's a Toronto Maple Leafs game. So I'm encouraging people, if you can, take the GO train. There's no traffic jams on the train tracks. And worst case scenario, it's about a 20-minute walk from the train station to the falls. So I'm bringing my bicycle down that day with a backpack, and I'm going to have everything that I need for the day, including my goggles, in my backpack, because I don't want to be beholden to the roadways in case I can't get through. So I'm preparing for the absolute worst, just in case.
Now, I want to get back to those people who are trying to make a little bit of cash off this and renting space for RVs and their driveways and whatnot. Do you have any sense of what are the going rates for those kinds of things?
No, I don't, but I know that I've talked to people that have vacation rentals on Airbnb or VRBO, and they said they're also getting premium rates. And I had a few people say, well, now I know why a year ago someone booked Monday, April the 8th. I wondered why. Now they know. So now they're upset that maybe they rented it too cheaply. So I don't know, but I know a lot of people are saying, well, boy, why don't we get, this will pay for our summer vacation. Why don't we bring some guests in the house? So there's a lot of that discussion. What the actual numbers are at this point, I don't know. And it'll be too much for us to track. I mean, there's too many balls in the air with what's happening right now. So we're just trying to get our head wrapped around. No matter what, we know it's going to be a record crowd in Niagara Falls. That we know. We know what it was like with Willenda with 150,000 people. What's the actual number? We don't know, but you have to be prepared for whatever that might be. So that's our goal. But how do you prepare for a million? I laughed. You're mentioning about, you know, how busy the subway is in Toronto. After a Blue Jay game, when you try to get back to the GO train, you know what it's like. And that's less than 50,000. I can't imagine with a crowd like that how we're going to deal with it. So I'm telling people, make sure your car's gassed up. Don't plan to do things when you get here. Come prepared. And if you can, it's going to be a long weekend. The Monday is not going to be school for any of the students. So come early. We've got a lot of programming for anyone into this whole celestial educational thing. This will be a fun weekend to do it. I know the restaurants and the hotels are doing a lot of programming around it. They're going to have fun with it. They're going to play with the theme.
And, you know, there are always these projections on economic impact. So do you have one for this? And barring that, what was the economic impact of Willenda, if we can multiply that?
You know, I don't have that at my fingertips, but it was very significant. We were told at the time, now that was 12 years ago, that 1 billion people tuned in within a 24-hour period. And, you know, it's funny. You know, of course, we're just coming out of COVID. It had a devastating effect on places like Niagara Falls, where 40,000 people count on tourism to feed their families. And now domestic tourism has gotten back to pre-pandemic levels, but international still lags behind. And something like this, although Niagara Falls is a huge brand like Coca-Cola and it's well known wherever you go, the problem is not that you're known, it's that you're talked about. So we need to take it from the back burner to the front burner, and we're hoping with all this global coverage that people will be saying, you know, I've never been to Niagara Falls, or we haven't been to Niagara Falls in a long time. Maybe now is the time, and many people will plan their trips. So,
and your Chamber of Commerce hasn't come up with a number?
They haven't yet. No, I think everybody's been caught a bit off guard with how big this is, the gravity of this event, and nobody really tuned in. It's funny, we started talking about it 2 years ago, but it wasn't really since the last few months that we really woke up to, oh my gosh, you know, get a bigger boat, as they said in Jaws.
Okay, thanks for that, and I hope that we can check in with you sometime before the blessed event to see if there's any more information. In the meantime, get back to your preps.
Okay, thanks for having me, Libby.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Okay, that is all the time we have for today, and yes, people, please think about what you might want to do for that eclipse, and you can let us know on Free for All Friday, which is coming up. And that is all the time we have for today.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio, heard weekdays from noon to one. This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show.